are you all bearing up at the end of a full day at Greenbelt? So are you still full of headspace and yeah? Good. Okay. Well, I'm Kate Monkhouse. I'm chairing the panel this afternoon, and we're going to be looking at civic space and the role that churches play within the public realm. We've got a really good panel. They'll get them to introduce themselves, but we'll also be looking for some comments and contributions from you as well, because I think this is an issue that all of us have got some experience of. So, before we get started, perhaps you could just do that classic thing and turn to your neighbour and don't groan, and tell them about the kind of the church space that you like the most. If you've got a favourite church building, it doesn't have to be a church building, it could be a building that for you is church, and just tell them what you like about it, just for 5 minutes, okay?
You like to introduce yourself and just say kind of what you do, and again, similar sort of questions. So I haven't had a chance to meet everybody beforehand, so I thought I'll just get everyone to warm up and let this as a chance to kind of breathe.
That's fine.
All right.
So lovely. just what I do.
Just ask five people in the audience to, if you're willing to stick your hand up and share very quickly. We've got the venue manager will just grab a mic, and so five people, what's your favourite church space? Stick your hand up if you're willing to share. Thank you. Somebody's got to go first.
I rather like Fontfroid Abbey in the south of France near Carcassonne.
Okay.
It's in a very beautiful setting. It's a very simple building. It's Romanesque. And there's some great light and great spaces. So spiritually, it was a great location. In terms of public space, pretty useless because it's in the middle of nowhere.
Thank you. There's a couple at the back. Sorry, I'm going to have to do some running.
Living in the rather crowded inner city, I like big, quiet spaces, spaces that aren't crowded. The biggest one I can think of is Liverpool Cathedral, which I think is magnificent. So, yes, but it's just rather dispiriting when there's only 20 of you in it.
Thank you.
I'd like to just tell you about one that I've been hearing about, which you can also experience tonight at 2300 hours in Fox Hunter's thing, because it ties in with something that I've experienced in a much smaller way, but it's about one in Germany, in Karlsruhe, which happens in a cafe throughout the week, as well as on Sundays, and so that people are coming in all the time. And I've been involved in something in the a very much smaller thing in the ashram community in Britain, which has also tried to have church-type things in cafes where people eat because that's what they need to do and then can get to talk to each other, and then there's the sort of inspiration of Christianity associated with that. So it's not like a cathedral at all.
Great, thank you. Yeah, there's one just behind you.
Cord is a very nice bar in the Northern Quarter in Manchester, and they have a particularly good selection of beers. And my church puts on a quarterly service there with electronica music and art installations, and that's one of my favourite church spaces, and also very accessible to people. Most people would be put off by most church buildings.
Great, thank you. And one last one. Yeah, lady in the middle.
Yes, this was a church I saw last week in the hills near Abergavenny. It's not a church I know particularly well, but it's right on the Offersdyke path, high up, with a pub and a bed and breakfast, which is oddly enough the old rectory. And the thing that I loved about it was very plain, very quiet, and in terms of public space, being right on the path, it was open all the time, which showed, I thought, a great deal of trust. And in the tower, there was a kettle and coffee and tea, and you could make it yourself, and obviously you were encouraged to sit and think about why the church was there. But it was just a lovely place to be, and you stood at the door, looked down the valley, and again, coming from the inner city, it was a stunning worship space. And I did actually manage to get in and get some quiet time when it wasn't full of walkers, which was lovely. Great. So I just, but the idea that it was there on the path, being there, I thought was really wonderful.
Fantastic. Thank you. Thank you for those. So, panellists, then, if you could perhaps just introduce yourself and say a little bit about what you do, and then perhaps explain what your favourite building is as well. Richard, can I start with you, then?
I'm Richard Giles, and I'm a presbyter, a priest of the Church of England, and I'm a gypsy because I've wandered over many dioceses of England and now find myself living in Philadelphia in the USA, where I look after the cathedral there. And our cathedral is one which was totally rethought as a sacred place 3 years ago. And when we kind of dismantled some of the Victorian furniture in this big space, you'll be pleased to know that I was likened to the Taliban in destroying the statues of the Buddha in Afghanistan. Such is the attachment to the bits and pieces of some of our worship spaces. And so I'm here for this festival to talk a little bit about that at other times. My favorite place, I think, my favorite sacred space would be a little church in Northamptonshire in a tiny village, which probably no one has ever heard of, called Chalveston, where when I was first ordained, I had the privilege of working with a small group of enthusiastic Christians to rethink again that little village church of the 13th century, how it could be not only a place of worship, but also a place for the community to meet and be engaged in their life together and to see a vision of God. And so, like most of us, I think a building is special to us for what it means to us in our journey. Maybe not for its architecture or for its dimensions or its importance, but what it means to us personally in our journey of faith. So little old Chalveston Church would have my vote. And I heard only a couple of months ago that after 30 years, this is, they finally put in the toilet in the church. So this process goes on.
Thank you. Anna.
Yeah, my name's Anna Minton, and I'm a writer and a journalist, and I was invited here to talk about my current project, which is on the privatization of public space and the growth of what is called private public space, which is privately owned but publicly accessible to most people, but not all, depending. In terms of sacred spaces, I can't really think of a sort of institutional type of sacred space that springs to mind for me. I think I can only sort of go to sort of examples in the natural world, walking in the countryside in North Wales. That's a natural sacred space for me, but that's in no way a civic space. So in terms of a civic space, there's nothing sacred about the pedestrianisation of Trafalgar Square, but I think it's a public space which has worked very, very well and has really changed part of central London. And it's really added to the organic sort of dynamism of the city in that part of London. You know, and I think we can get a little bit too high flown about sort of creating, you know, really sort of sacred spaces. We're talking about how cities work and how they can work best, you know, and sort of maximising civic life. So that would be the example that I would choose in this context.
Great. Thank you. Eyal.
My name is Eyal. I'm an architect. I originally come from Israel. Now I'm based both in Israel, here and in Vienna. I teach architecture in London. Yeah, that's my background. I was here speaking about the architectural spatial dimension of the Israeli occupation in the West Bank and trying to actually read politics through the forms and formal organization that it produces. I don't know much about churches. I do like the one next to my house on Brick Lane. It's nothing in particular in terms of a building, but its history saw it as a initially as a Huguenot church, I think. Then it became a synagogue. Now it's a mosque. And I like the way in which each one of those kind of generations of use have left a sediment within the building. So you can actually read that, its history, on small modifications. There's a, over the main doorway, there has been an arch added when it became a synagogue. It's not very spectacular, but it's still there now that it's a mosque. And kind of what is very interesting is that I could actually look into that building from my back bathroom window. It means that they could look back into it as well. now that I say it, it's kind of come to my mind. But essentially, what is really interesting is that you see that the whole geometry, the whole internal organization of the building has changed because Mecca was 17 degrees off the axis of the building. So that everything within the kind of the internal kind of main hall has been shifted 17 degrees. And those kind of, you know, small modifications that that had to be done and partitions on the 17 degrees really somehow become the sort of the nexus of architecture and community for me. And the way in which buildings can have a life beyond what they were designed to do and But more than that, of course they can have a life beyond what they're designed to do. In what way does the spirit that have created them in the first place actually continues? In what way does the fact that it is a mosque now and it was a synagogue, it was a church before, informs a particular way of practice, a particular way of use in a building? And I find that very interesting.
Thank you. Elizabeth.
My name is Elizabeth Baylis. I'm the director of an organization called Social Action for Health, which is a community development charity working in East and South East London. We work on health inequalities, so we work a lot with minority communities, which these days includes the white working class community elders amongst the white working class community who get described as the left behind. In boroughs like Tower Hamlets, where our head office is, we work a lot there where you have just one or two people who are left behind, with new communities coming in, and those people don't know how to engage with people from another community, Bengali women who live in private space often and who don't have access to public space that's safe. It's very important. Some of the elderly white women are yearning to make contact, but don't know how. So that's one of the things that we do. So we work with the Bengali, Somali, Caribbean, Turkish, Kurdish communities, and it's a great privilege to be able to do so. We, in terms of space, I'm going to be greedy. I'll just be quick. The canals in East London are absolutely fabulous public spaces. I was out there one day on my bicycle, and you have, on a sunny day, you have the kids playing out. Now it's the summer holidays. You have the alkies hanging around drinking. You have the serious cyclists who are like, you know, bullets that go down and you have to avoid them. You have the mums and babies out there enjoying the sunshine. You have everybody you can think of, and so that's wonderful, safe space that everybody feels is theirs. And so you get the kids, you know, the groups of teenagers, the hoodies with their it's fabulous, it's really good. And then the building that we have our office in is an old youth club that was built in the 1920s in the middle of Whitechapel, which is now, through lottery money, being converted into a gorgeous community space, which is an art gallery. It's got a theatre space with retractable seats. It's wooden floor, stage, fantastic sound, kitchen, and that is used, that is owned by everybody, and people use it, Bengalis, Somalis. We have the summer university running there where you get the noise level of these Bengali and Somali kids. You know, on a Friday night, if you go in there at the end of summer university, the noise is bouncing off the ceiling. We've had seminars, 300 people in there, very easily, cross-cultural stuff. People feel easy about going in there, and that's one of the things for me makes it very special and sacred, that people feel completely comfortable. Mums let their teenage girls come in. Veiled women come and speak at seminars comfortably. It's a wonderful space, so that's, I guess, an example.
Sort of an East London theme coming out already. Yeah. So a couple of questions to the panel then. Churches, or indeed religious buildings, thinking both within our sort of diverse cities in this country but also overseas, have a role as public spaces as well as places for worship. How important is that, and what degree should they have in terms of reflecting the culture and the community that they serve? Yeah.
Shall I have a go first? I think it is very important, because certainly traditionally in our country, the parish church has been a place of meeting, encounter between culture and our worship. And in hundreds of years ago, in the medieval period, there were no pews in our churches, because people stood and often chatted and met on Sunday morning, talking about all kinds of things, until a bell rang and they paid attention to the liturgy which was going on beyond the screen in what we call the chancel now. It was a house of the community, of the people of God, as well as being a house of prayer. And obviously that has its dangers, but I think that today it's exciting that many of our church buildings are becoming places where the community are welcomed back in, and so that we can communicate as Christians our vision of God and God's kingdom, but they can root us and ground us in the real world, so that this this conversation, this dialogue, is fruitful for all humankind. So I think we need to preserve that tradition, which is very ancient in our land, and modify it and develop it for our own generation.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's also very important, but my feeling is that it's desperately underused. And I think the main reason for that has got to be a lack of funding and a lack of resources, because there simply isn't the money to put on activities, events, etc., which are going to be popular with the community, if you're going to be reaching out beyond the immediate faith community in the area, which I think, you know, is what church buildings should be doing if they're going to re-establish that community focus that they had when, you know, it went without saying that people would sort of gravitate to there. So I mean, you know, that's probably the first factor. And then I think the second factor is relevant activities, ensuring that relevant activities are planned, and, you know, really the local community is reached out to, and I'm sure this varies a lot, you know, up and down the country. I'm sure there are some particularly inner city church spaces which are very actively used by very active community groups, and, you know, others perhaps less so. But, you know, I think it's like it's an incredible resource which is there, and it really should be used much more.
Perhaps for the sake of conversation, when I heard the lady on my left speaking about a community center and what it kind of provide in terms of intercommunal events, I was really thinking whether a church, a synagogue, a mosque, really as an institution that is based on religion, can provide that what is essential now, and this is a kind of an intercommunal communication. It seems that in times of crisis, when each one withdraws into his community, it develops a little bit perhaps of an exclusive sort of debate that is, of course, liberal and open and wants to engage, but still happens between the members of a particular religion. And many times the problem are between and perhaps should be resolved in a forum that is less based on religion and perhaps more on other commonalities.
It's one of the things that is, when you're doing community work, there's a sort of sense that you have to find places that are safe for everybody, so that people, it's like a neutral space. I used to draw people together many years ago, and I was running a consortium of community groups, and we said that people left their swords at the door, or you know those cowboy films where they say you had to leave the guns at the end of the street with the sheriff, and you'd come into a space, and then you could be a different sort of person within that space. That's what I think we need to do, to try to create in very crowded, very dense areas, places where people can leave their, you know, leave their battle wares behind. And sometimes churches are overly partisan, but I'm very interested in the number of times that when workers in our organisation create social events, like, you know, we had a maternity conference recently, and we had, and it was in a church space, explicitly a church space, and the received wisdom is that Muslims won't come into a church space. And in fact, we had Orthodox Jewish women, we had Muslim women, we had Caribbean women, we had white English middle class women, all comfortably, and African women, West African women, which is actually quite important and difficult to achieve. We had all those women together in this church space, and I was interested that it was possible. And I think there's something about the space being flexible enough for it to be owned on the day by whoever is inhabiting it. And I think that's very difficult, but I think it's very important, without losing the clarity of purpose as church, I think, and the Christian basis of it. If it is a church, it should be a church. It's like the mosque down the road from us, East London Mosque, fabulous new building that was £9 million. £1 million was raised last year by the local people in 1 month during Ramadan to contribute towards the building of it. It's fabulous, and there you can do all sorts of other things, not just Muslim things, not just Islamically based things. It's very precious space. Those are the places that we need.
So we're talking a lot about communities and belonging. Richard and Neil, you both design spaces, don't you? How is it that the architecture or the built environment can actually make those things possible? Or indeed, as Anna was talking about, Trafalgar Square is another kind of civic space. How do we design those places to enable these things to happen?
Right. Well, I think it's just, first of all, just remind ourselves of the power of the building, of space, volume, dimensions to affect us and influence our way of thinking and acting. And we know this is true from every aspect of our lives, from the room, even if it's just a bedsit, what posters we put on the wall, how we light it, how we arrange it. As a student, I remember when life got boring, I used to rearrange the furniture in my room just to give it a new lease of life. It was a very mundane, mass-produced kind of student accommodation, but I realized that you could tweak it, you could play with it, you could make it a bit different. And I think if we apply that lesson of our living space or our office space, our school space, wherever we spend most of our time, to the spaces which enhance our spiritual lives and our engagement with all others on a journey of faith, irrespective of tradition, then we should remember how vital it is to spend time on the space and not to see it as some aesthetic little hobby for those who like that kind of thing, but as a primary interest for people of faith, because the building will shape us. You know, Winston Churchill famously said, we shape our buildings, and our buildings then shape us. Because we are affected, we're influenced, we are depressed, we're inspired. All these things can be consequences of the space we inhabit or worship in or meet in. And so I just think that's the first thing to remember, and then to apply the lessons of our daily life to our spiritual spaces, the spaces where we meet and encounter God and one another, and not to treat our spiritual spaces as museums, but really tweak them and knock them into shape. Otherwise, we shall become wax effigies instead of living people.
Elizabeth, you were nodding. Yeah. Did you want to add anything?
Well, I think buildings do affect you, and I think sometimes some of the churches that we see around us that are so dead, and people struggling. We know we've got some in East London. People struggle to keep them going, and they are worn out by the struggle to keep these buildings going. And I just feel sorry for the people who are doing so, and it's like they've got this horrible, great big thing around their neck, and they just need to let go, I think, in some cases. They haven't got any time for outreaching or saying or a welcoming, loving welcome to anybody. They're so busy being oppressed by the loos or something.
In London, which is the city where I live as well at the moment, we have a regional spatial development strategy which is looking at influencing planning. And I wanted to ask Anna and Eyal as well about the way in which political priorities actually can help shape these spaces, and the degree to which regeneration policy can enhance or degrade the built environment. And perhaps from the Israeli perspective as well, the way in which, you know, the way the planning, in a sense, has actually helped with that process as well. Perhaps you could both reflect on that.
Well, I mean, obviously, regeneration is something that we see all around us in London, right? And this is it is a process that completely kind of transforms an environment, and very often the reliance that financing such thing has on private money means that a lot of the spaces that are created are camouflaged public spaces. I think this is what Anna's thesis is in a certain way as well. And we have to be aware of these spaces. I'd let you speak about them more, because a public space that a space that looks as if it's public space but is actually private hides some restrictions in it that that do not allow us to completely use it democratically. So I think that it is really the role of public institution to demand real public institution, real public spaces whenever there is a development. And we have to understand that municipalities and the public has power in that game. And sometimes it gives away that power all too cheaply and easily. As a matter of fact, you know, it's almost like the power to print money, right? This is what the public has. How high a building could be for a developer means, you know, for him everything. And you can demand real thing from him, not a kind of those sort of camouflage public space that we were saying, but to really build theaters that are public, community centers, parks, etc., and to use private money beyond the ability of the private sector to control the way it is going to be the way it is going to be spent. I don't want to be too technical about that, but I think it's very, very important to realize that the public has power in this. As a matter of fact, at the end of the day, all the power to decide what is happening. I think that regarding kind of the spaces themselves of the church that we were speaking, I think that when one thinks about architecture, there's almost two aspects to it. There's the kind of the symbolic aspect of architecture, and it's the way how it communicates. Our architecture is a language. And I'd be wary of that sort of aspect of architecture to tell a story, because then the story can be very often limited and appealed only to a particular part of the population. I think that the new public spaces, the new communal spaces, it could be religious or not, have to be flexible, have to allow very many different uses that perhaps, as you well said, a kind of a cathedral-type space is perhaps good for one thing, but is very bad in doing others. It's very bad in sometimes being intimate. So I think that kind of creating this sort of neutral boxes that could be adapted, could be manipulated, could be tweaked, as you said, I think are the way forward in that, in such a flexible sort of social environment.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, policy towards regeneration is absolutely key with regard to the type of public realm that we're creating, particularly at the moment when so much regeneration is going on. You know, every town and city around the country is having its city centre rebuilt. London is, you know, East London is going to be a huge construction site with the Olympics, Stratford City, etc. And really what the subject of my talk earlier is that the way that all these public spaces are being created is through this sort of private-public model, as Ale mentioned. And this has got really big implications for actually how the public realm is going to look like. It's going to be much more security conscious, security guards everywhere, certain types of behaviours and activities basically not allowed. I mean, that sort of sounds as if I'm being, you know, sort of sensational, but it really is very much the case. And I was very struck by Elizabeth's example of her favourite place, the canal, you know, where you've got absolutely everybody, every kind of activity and every kind of person, from your street drinker to your cyclist to your mothers and babies, etc. And, you know, that's your ideal public space. Well, it's my ideal public space as well. But the nature of these private public developments is really very, very much the opposite of that. Homeless people tend not to be allowed. Begging absolutely is not allowed. But I mean, even quite innocuous activities like rollerblading or skateboarding, etc., these aren't allowed either. So, I mean, that's a result partly of the growth of these big public, private public developments, but also policy is tending in that direction as well, with the encouragement of what's known as business improvement districts, where local businesses pay a tax to fund improvements to the public realm. And this really brings me on to the point that Ayel made, which is that, you know, local people do actually have quite a lot of power, and they're actually giving it away without realizing it, because the implication of these kind of policies is that if in fact business improvement districts are going to be making the decisions about the local area, that takes the decision making power away from the locally elected members of the local authority. But these are the directions that we're moving in. You know, that's not to sort of paint some totally over the top dystopian vision of the entire country, because this is only in areas where regeneration projects are occurring, or well, in many city centres as well. You know, but I think, unfortunately, I have great concerns about a lot of the policy directions that we're going in.
Okay, thank you very much for your reflections so far. I'm going to open it up to the floor. We've got a mic to roam around. So if you could pop your hand up clearly and then keep questions reasonably short so that we can fit plenty in before we wrap up.
Reflecting on the nature of space, the use of space, and development of church spaces, I've had a relationship with the Methodist Church for some years. And at the moment, I see fairly large churches which have a history as municipal churches with thriving communities in the 1930s and 40s, with a whole range of different social programs, which are effectively being managed by now by chapel communities, trying to manage these large municipal buildings. And the Methodist Church also has a history of redeveloping their property to provide accommodation. And this is this expresses an enlightened social policy in many cases in areas where we're short of housing. Where we are in the inner city, we're losing lots and lots of tiny little green spaces around the place, and they're increasing the population density enormously. Now, it seems to me that I can think of one building in particular that if it was redeveloped into a chapel in a garden, this would sort of create a new kind of landscape in that area. But I just wonder if that kind of manifesto, as it were, is tenable in the current sort of climate.
I think we'll take a few questions at a time, and then we'll come back and reflect on them as well. So.
Right, I'm trying to write this down so I don't talk too long, but there's been lots of mention of the idea of the inside of churches being used as public spaces, so the idea of getting the mums together from different communities and things like that. Richard alluded to the medieval and the way in which the sacred, I think he was trying to get around to the saying about sacred spaces being used as profane. You had a market in the cathedral, words gone, bit where you walk in, market sort of thing. No, yeah, that'll do, Nave. But I would want to say, therefore, how does this debate open up further and look at the way in which during the medieval and within Old Testament literature you have the notion of the sacred being taken out into the profane as well, and so there's a really blurry line between the holy space and holy space is taken from within a holy place to the profane, and the whole kind of merging of things could be the key to developing really spiritual locations, be them inside or outside a church building. So I wonder what you thought about that.
Just the point made about the power of communities is that I think there's also a point that we also have the power is that there's also consumer choices that are being made in the way that we choose to live, which has affected the way our cities are developed, so that they're now extruded along development based around the use of the car, which has had a huge impact on city centres and the way that they're the implosion of city centres and the areas that basically lie that are not well connected in terms of road infrastructure. And although we have choices within the, say, how we influence the planning system, we also have consumer choices, which are the weight of which is totally against the provision of public space.
Okay, panel, don't feel like all of you need to respond to every single question, but reflections on those three so far then.
The point about taking the holy, taking the sacred out into the profane feels to me very attractive and important. It's one of those lovely cairns that you get in Scotland where you've got some group of people who have put some stones there and for a special reason. I think it would be really good to do some of that in our spaces, in our public spaces in London. I've wondered about where you hear stories about South America. My husband's been there and he says you've just got these things that are just there, just a few images or a few icons just sort of there, and that's become a holy space for a group of people. And I do think that we could do more to claim our spaces, our public spaces, and make them so that people are self-conscious about valuing them more, because otherwise they might get lost, it sounds like, which sounds really frightening.
Yes, I'd like to go back to that question too. I think I'm right in saying that there is an uneasiness today amongst many faith traditions about talking about sacred spaces at all, because there's an inference that the rest of space isn't sacred. And that barrier between sacred and profane, I think, is perhaps certainly unfashionable, or increasingly so, because we have perhaps a more positive attitude to God's creative power. And I think sacred space is made sacred and holy by what goes on in that space and by the people who make it holy. Just think of this race course before us here. For most of the year, this space is a place where races are held and fortunes may be won or lost. Not necessarily a place which is always holy at all, and yet Greenbelt will make it holy. It is a gathering we shall all remember as a very spiritual experience. So I think the space itself can be, same space can be often holy or profane, depending on what we do with it. And we should have a greater awareness for our potential under God for creating with God what is holy and special and sacred.
Yeah, I'll just pick up on a couple of points. The first point about the very large church building, and you're wondering whether it would be better as a smaller space with green space around it. And I mean, that just brings me back really to the first point I think that someone made, just talking about the importance of churches as a community focus and how that importance has declined over the last generation or two. And I'm sure that this particular church that you described, I mean, this situation is being mirrored, up and down the country. And I think, you know, it's very important to get some real creative thinking going about how best to use that amazing resource, because it's very sad to see the places underused. And I think it would also be very sad to knock them down and replace them with a sort of something smaller. You know, it's very nice to sort of finding new uses for old spaces is a much more positive way forward, I would have thought. But I think definitely some kind of strategy about this issue is needed. The final point, I was going to mention something
In terms of the way we're using our towns and cities and... Come back to it later. Don't worry. Okay, let's have some more questions then. Sorry, there were just in the middle.
I'd like to pick up the last question that was made about power and community, people in community and power. With regeneration, expansion of cities, the general public and people of faith are being asked to give their opinions and being consulted. Part of that, to be consulted requires, and to engage in that consultation requires a great deal of technical language and sophisticated awarenesses. How can we get resources as people of faith and to respond to these consultations? Where do we get resources from? How do we get those resources, really? To engage really well, to take the power that is ours as consumers and as people of faith.
Another couple of questions before we come back to the panel, yeah?
Probably a question for Richard, mostly. I'm presently chaplain at Leicester Cathedral. I don't know if you've ever had the pleasure of seeing Leicester. It's a rather small cathedral, ex-parish church, pillars all over the place, very haphazard, and the Victorians really boshed it up. We also have precincts that are extensively used by local young people. So we've kind of got this juxtaposition of pillars, old ladies, skateboarders, drug dealers, chavs, goths. I'm not quite sure which group I'm most scared of. But the question is, how can we communicate a sense of, I'm not going to use sacred and profane, I'm going to use transcendence and immanence. how can we communicate a sense of transcendence and immanence, both inside that building and outside that building, that isn't saying to people, you are here, you have to behave in this way, but actually makes them want to behave in a particular kind of way.
Anyone?
Yeah.
So.
The government's planning to build hundreds of thousands of new houses down in the southeast of England, in many different parts of the country down there. And when we look at the planning of that settlement, and we look at what we want to take part, my gentleman's question down here about consultation, what exactly are we thinking about what we want as a church? Are we wanting to put a parish church in there, or are we wanting to create something different? What do you think we're actually wanting to put into place? So perhaps a bit of creative juices.
The Methodist churches in northeast London has employed somebody to look at putting the community into these new developments in Thames Gateway and the M11 corridor. 500,000 new homes are planned. And I said in my talk this morning that Ken Livingstone said to some faith leaders who were there, we can do the buildings, we can do the housing, we can get all of that done, the streetlights, but we can't do community. That's up to the faith communities. And that's something, it's a big responsibility that we've got. What are we going to do about the racism in Romford? When you've got a whole load of new African families coming in, what are they going to be faced with? How is it going to be built? These communities, that the symbols, the buildings are important, but it feels to me that the quality of relationships are more important. And so far I've been sitting on this group looking at these new developments for a year now within the Methodist Church, and we were planning to talk community development from day one, and we haven't talked anything but buildings. And I have really tried to get them to talk about people. So there's a sort of danger about buildings becoming the... because they're easy for people to focus on. They have edges, you know, there are so many bricks, there are so many windows. You can talk about buildings much more easily than you can the relationships between people and how to create open communities. And can I just quickly say about where you get your money from to get involved with campaigning to take the democratic power that is yours? This is really important, and there are websites, but the thing to think about is getting, depends where you live, whether you're in a neighbourhood renewal area or not. But if you are in one of the 88 most deprived boroughs in the country, they will have these local strategic partnerships, and those local strategic partnerships have money, and part of that money will take the form of a community chest of some sort. And that community chest will be available for people who are wanting to organise around consultation. And there are charities that do it as well, but that's certainly a very accessible form of funding. You know, 5,000 up to 5,000 at a time.
Yeah, just to pick up on your point about consultation, I mean, I think actually it's not that difficult to understand what's being talked about if you get the information. That's the main problem. And actually my sort of personal and kind of professional life sort of merged quite recently when there was a big scheme near where I live in Brixton to totally redevelop the centre of Brixton. And there was quite a big outcry over some of the plans. But the main problem was that residents really hadn't been told what was going on, you know. And once we started asking what was going on and started finding out what was going on, it wasn't like any of this was particularly difficult. It's just that we hadn't been given the information. And I think that's the key issue with consultation. You know, quite often consultation is a tick box thing, and local authorities or whatever groups have to sort of carry it out, say, oh, they've done it, and you know, they did it in 2003 or whatever. And then you go back to 2003 and you find they got 150 replies back from a borough-wide survey, and they called that a consultation. So really, it's actually getting the information in the first place, which is the problem. But I don't think you should feel intimidated by the technical language of a regeneration scheme, because it's rarely that complex. You've just got to be aware of what your local authority is doing, and you know, quite often they're going to hide the things they don't want you to know about. So that's the problem. But just the other point I wanted to pick up on was
just
your
quickly.
Sorry. You just mentioned consumer choice earlier, and you know that's a good point, and it's a sort of symbiotic issue, obviously. But I mean, I think some of the private public spaces that are being created would not be everybody's choice. They might be some people's, but I certainly don't think they'd be other people's choice in terms of what we were discussing, and in terms of exclusion. But yeah,
Eel, any points before we close?
Perhaps just a brief one to do with how to resist. One has to remember, this is something that we face very much in Israel and Palestine, that when people want to do something, they would wrap it up in very kind of professional, technological knowledge just to alienate you out of the discussion. And I think it's just very, very important initially to know what you want and to not to kind of get carried away into any of the sort of technicalities, because they'll explain to you that you need the tube to pass exactly through here and not from there, and therefore you need this and this and that. It just at a certain point, if you are led by the inherent logic of development, it often just leads to its own conclusion. You need to kind of avoid speaking about that, focus about what you want and what you don't want, and stick to your guns. I think this is somehow an advice that is just very important. Whenever you kind of you try to operate in opposition, it is not your role to be carried away and kind of to discuss the technological side of things, but to stand firm on your right.
Thank you. And Richard, just to close now.
Well, just that I know the Leicester question has gone unanswered. Sorry. Just to say, I think that inside our spaces, very briefly, I think if we can provide spaces which take people by surprise, which are not the predictable inside of a church full of lots of furniture and sometimes junk, but are places of serenity and peace, which develop the wow factor, so that people who have no contact with faith community come in and are instantly entranced by them. The highest compliment paid to our renovation scheme in Philadelphia, when two very posh old ladies from the wealthier suburbs came in and said to one another in disgusted tones, "It's just like a mosque." And that really is what we were trying to do, create a neutral space where prayer, where God is enthroned, but which is surprising, which is different from the expected. And secondly, I think the outside is more difficult, how to engage people who gather or meet or mingle around our buildings. I think that being in America, I realized, the setback of having commuter clergy, and how in England, certainly in the Church of England, we still live over the shop. And I think living where we work, however difficult the circumstances, is a great sign of solidarity and engagement. And to actually engage with those people, even with their problems, even with the noise they make, even if they're inconvenient to us, to see whether there can be some dialogue, real dialogue, and some accommodation with responsibility between us.
Thank you. Hope you enjoy being in this space in Cheltenham this weekend, and would you join me in giving thanks to the panel?